our visiting judge, James Otero, from the district court based in Los Angeles, California. He volunteered to sit with us, and we're pleased to have him on this panel and assisting our court. Our judges frequently sit with other courts, and we find the reciprocal arrangement to be of great help to the court. So we recognize his service, and we thank him for visiting with us.
Thank you.
Before we address the arguments in the Abbott case, I have a separate piece of business having to do with the admission to the bar of our court of several individuals. They are seated here, namely my three law clerks, John Lee, Rachelle Thompson, and Christy Rupert. So if you will come forward and to the podium. Since I can't preside and be the movement at the same time, Judge Dyke will preside over the motion proceeding. Judge Dyke, I have a motion to present to the court.
Chief Judge Michel, your motion.
I move the admission of the three named individuals to be admitted and sworn as members of the Bar of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. I certify that they, in each case, are a member of the Bar of the Court of the highest court in their respective states, and that they are fully qualified by reason of training and experience, as well as state bar admission, to be admitted to this court. I certify their good character as well as their legal learning.
Okay. Judge Otero, shall we grant the motion?
Absolutely.
Well, the motion is granted, and Mr. Lee, Ms. Thompson, Ms. Rupert, welcome to the bar of this court.
Congratulations.
The clerk will administer the oath.
Please raise your right hand. You swear or affirm that you report yourself as attorney of this court, uprightly and according to law, and that you support the Constitution of the United States of America.
Thank you, and we hope that we'll see you before too long standing at the podium arguing cases, as many former clerks have done. And I also observe that the best fringe benefit of being a federal judge, trial or appellate, is having law clerks. So thank you for your service and your good company.
Congratulations.
We have three cases before the panel this morning. Two are being submitted on the briefs today without oral argument. They are namely Appeal Number 06-7378, Collins v. Department of Veterans Affairs, and Appeal Number 06-3345, Caracciolo v. Office of Personnel Management. We'll hear argument now in Abbott Labs, Appeal Number 07-1019. Counsel, good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. Please proceed.
I will address two errors from the district court this morning: the district court's assumption of jurisdiction and its failure to give Apotex the opportunity to fully present its case once it did assume jurisdiction. On the first point, the district court had no jurisdiction to enjoin the acts of Apotex that had occurred here. The district court had no jurisdiction to hold a contempt proceeding when there were no acts that had occurred in violation of its prior injunction. That injunction prohibited the commercial manufacture, use, sale, offer for sale, or importation of the divalproic sodium that had been found to be infringing. There's no dispute here that those acts have not occurred. The original injunction also prohibited FDA from finally approving the Torfarm ANDA that had been the subject of the original litigation. And there's no contention here that that was not about to occur.
But wouldn't the injunction also bar the FDA from approving an ANDA for an equivalent drug?
You mean a bioequivalent drug?
Yeah, something that was not colorably different from the original. Wouldn't the injunction reach that? In other words, wouldn't the FDA be prohibited under the injunction from approving a virtually identical product that was the subject of a new ANDA?
Well, the first response to that is that under the statute, Congress expressly limited the remedies available in Hatch-Waxman cases.
Well, we're not talking about remedies, we're talking about jurisdiction. You're saying that the district court in the proceeding on appeal utterly lacked jurisdiction.
That's correct.
And then the reason you seem to give is that the remedies of the Hatch-Waxman Act are limited. I don't understand the connection.
The district court had no authority to enjoin Apotex or anybody else from filing a new ANDA and seeking FDA approval of that new ANDA.
Why not?
Because the statute doesn't permit it.
It doesn't need the statute. It's enforcing its earlier judgment. It has inherent authority to enforce earlier judgments. It has statutory authority under the All Writs Act and other statutes to enforce its prior judgments.
Right, but its prior judgment, the issue that was before the district court in the prior decision was, does this Torpharm ANDA product infringe Abbott's patents? And here, this is a new ANDA that the district court took jurisdiction
over. Let's address some of Judge Posner's concerns. How do we stop a party from securing a straw man, refiling a new ANDA describing a generic identical to a drug which was the subject of prior litigation? How do we address those concerns?
Well, if the issue here is not that Apotex took the old ANDA, slapped a new cover on it, and refiled it. What Apotex did here was they went back, they attempted to design around the patents, which they were entitled to do, and the way in which they went through that design around path is they took the product and they dissolved it in water, which Abbott's expert had said is going to destroy the oligomer.
That's not the findings of Judge Posner, and in many ways the most troubling aspect of the case, at least from a trial court's perspective, and I sit on a trial court, is the findings of Judge Posner. And Judge Posner, on page 840 of his opinion, says that Mr. Sherman made only minor modifications unsupported by any scientific rationale. It behooved him to conduct scientific testing. His failure to conduct any scientific testing and cavalier disregard for judicial findings were the antithesis of good faith.
Right. And let me respond to that. Because what Judge Posner, as I interpret that passage you're talking about there, as being concerned about, is that Apotex had not in advance done product-to-product comparison testing between the Torpharm product and the new farm product. The problem, though, is why would Apotex have done that type of analysis when it had not commercially manufactured, used, sold, offered for sale, or imported divalproxodium into the United States? All of the activities that Apotex did were based in Canada, and U.S. patents don't have an extraterritorial reach to Canada, and Apotex was not planning on bringing this product to market. So if they're not planning on bringing this product to market, why should they be anticipating that they're going to get brought into court on some quasi-contempt proceeding?
But that seems to be a different question as to whether they should have tested the thing. But what I'm trying to understand is, what's the jurisdictional contention? Is it that any time there's a new ANDA, that's not within the scope of the injunction? In fact, the district court lacks authority to include a second ANDA within its original injunction?
Well, I think...
Or is it because it's a different product?
Both. When you have a new ANDA filing, and Congress wants to encourage people to file new ANDAs, and you should, even if you've been subject to a prior injunction where your prior product was found to infringe, if you go forward and do a new product and new process, you're entitled to file a new ANDA. The injunctive relief that the district court was originally authorized to issue was not, I'm going to prevent you from filing any new ANDAs. The statute specifically says that the remedies are limited to ordering FDA that you cannot finally approve the ANDA, and you cannot commercially make, use, sell, offer for sale, or import.
But if I understand the FDA statute correctly, that you could have a new ANDA, which was directed to an absolutely identical product. I'm not talking about one that's different in any respect. Am I mistaken about that?
Under FDA's regulations, we would have been able to file that identical ANDA again. I don't necessarily see why any generic drug company would do that, because, you know, for reasons of issue preclusion, claim preclusion, the fact that, you know, attorney fees are available as a remedy under Section 285, it wouldn't make sense for somebody to go do that. I mean, we've been having Hatch-Waxman litigation for over 25 years. There are plenty of generic companies that have been enjoined. Nobody's ever tried to go do that to get around the injunction. What usually happens is what happened in the Glaxo v. Novapharm case. In that case, Novapharm was found to infringe by its first product because it conceded infringement and it only challenged validity. And when it lost, Novapharm went back, did a new ANDA, and during the course of the infringement proceedings, which was a full trial, not some contempt proceeding, but a full trial, Novapharm was able to demonstrate non-infringement.
I still don't understand your point about why there's a lack of jurisdiction. You seem to just be repeating the statement that the Hatch Act remedies are limited. We know they're limited. We know what they are. You've written in the brief reminding us what they are, and you've reminded us again. I don't see what that has to do with why a court would be said to lack jurisdiction to conduct a contempt proceeding for an apparent violation of its prior injunction.
But there is no violation of the prior injunction.
Well, that's the issue in the case.
Right, but how could there be a violation of the prior injunction when the injunction itself was limited to telling FDA you can't approve that Torfarm ANDA and telling Apotex you cannot commercially make, use, sell, offer for sale, or import into the United States? That's all that the original injunction prohibited. And there's no dispute here that FDA didn't approve that ANDA, and there's no dispute here that Apotex was not bringing its product into the United States. And without a predicate act in violation of the injunction, how can there even be jurisdiction for a district court to hold a contempt proceeding?
Well, because a repetitive filing would be contrary to the original injunction.
But this wasn't a repetitive filing. This was.
Well, that's what the dispute was about, that the contempt proceeding resolved. But as I understand you, you're saying Judge Posner was not allowed to have a contempt proceeding here, was not allowed to adjudicate whether the product was the same or was materially changed. You seem to be saying he wasn't allowed to do anything. He had no jurisdiction. He was not allowed to open court that day. And I'm having a lot of trouble understanding how that could be so.
Because there was no act by Apotex in violation of that injunction. If the injunction doesn't prohibit Apotex from doing something, I can't be in violation of the injunction. And it's being in violation of the injunction, first and foremost, that has to prompt a contempt proceeding. You know, what's different about this case is that there has been no traditional act of infringement. You know, usually in a contempt proceeding...
It doesn't help me for you to say traditional act of infringement, because Congress has made filing an ANDA an act of infringement.
No, that's not correct. What Congress has designated as an act of infringement is the submission of an ANDA with a paragraph 4 certification saying that that is in error. That when you make your paragraph 4 certification, you were wrong to represent that this commercial manufactured use or sale of this product upon final FDA approval would be outside the scope of the patent, or that the patents are invalid. The act of infringement is the submission of an erroneous paragraph 4 certification. I mean, that's why Congress created the paragraph 4 certification, because all of the activities relating to filing the ANDA, preparing the ANDA, submission of the bio studies, preparation of the bio batches, that's all activities that is protected from infringement under the safe harbor provisions.
Let's talk about the filing of the second ANDA. That was done by Mr. Benyak. And Judge Posner found that he was acting as a stalking horse for Apotex. The person who files an ANDA, according to the statute, must have personal knowledge of the truth of the matters asserted in the ANDA. Mr. Banyak doesn't manufacture drugs. He had no basis to make the declaration because he didn't have any personal knowledge. That sounds like a stalking horse.
Well, I disagree with the assertion that Mr. Banyak did not have knowledge.
That's the Judge Posner's findings.
Right. Well, the record indicates otherwise. New Farm was the sponsor of the ANDA, and quite frankly, it's not unusual for generic drug companies to have contract manufacturers and to outsource having biostudies done. That happens all the time. There's a reason why the bulk of the drug manufacturers are not based in the United States. They're based in India. A lot of them are based in China. They're based in Europe. These drugs are not necessarily manufactured in the United States. You use contract manufacturers to make this stuff and to do the biostudies. So that in and of itself is not something that's particularly unusual here. But even if you wanted to get into this idea that Judge Posner did have jurisdiction here, at the very least, Apotex should have been given the opportunity, procedurally, to go out and do the product-to-product comparison testing. We did do that testing. We got it to Judge Posner within a week after he had this hearing, which in and of itself was given to us on 6 days' notice. And he struck all of that evidence that showed that this is a different product, that you can't say that these two products are identical.
Well, that's an argument that he abused his discretion by holding a summary contempt proceeding.
Absolutely. And we contend that that the district court did abuse its discretion when it held the summary contempt proceeding. There was no reason to be rushing through all this. And when we specifically asked Judge Posner for time to do these tests, we were under the impression that we would be given some opportunity to do these tests. We did present these tests, and they contradicted the story that Abbott had given to the district court, and those tests and that evidence was stricken, and not because it didn't comply with the federal rules of evidence, and not because procedurally...
You had plenty of time to do your tests. The first injunction in Abbott reissued in March 04. The second ANDA application by New Farm was filed in March of 05. That's a year. Abbott sued New Farm in June of 05, and then the evidentiary hearing before Judge Posner took place in August of 06.
We did not have the time because there was no reason for Apotex to contemplate it was going to get hauled into some pseudo-contempt proceeding when it wasn't even doing anything, delivering any product into the United States.
When were the expert reports due in the original infringement proceeding?
The original expert reports that New Farm had presented on the invalidity issues were submitted in July, and it was 2 weeks after Abbott got those expert reports with the single crystal studies that Abbott decided that they wanted to go in front of Judge Posner.
Isn't there a pretty good argument that even in the infringement suit it would have been too late to bring in these additional expert findings that you sought to introduce before Judge Posner?
No, that's not accurate, actually. Abbott filed its motion in front of Judge Posner before the deadline for New Farm to respond to the expert reports that Abbott had issued in that.
So you would have had another opportunity in the infringement suit to file additional expert reports?
Absolutely. And the other thing, too, is, you know, in that case,
what was the date of the rebuttal expert reports?
The rebuttal expert reports weren't due until September.
Until September what?
September of 06, and then there would have been a further opportunity for experts.
So the hearing before Judge Posner was September 06, right?
No, the hearing before Judge Posner was August 31st of 06. Right.
So when were the expert reports due?
The expert reports before Judge Pohlmeier were due, I want to say, September 15th or September 6th. I would have to check the schedule in order to be exactly sure. The original expert...
And when did you submit the supplemental expert reports to Judge Posner?
We submitted them on September 6th.
So that was before the date that they would have been due to Judge Pohlmeier.
Right. And Judge Pohlmeier suspended all of the proceedings before her. But, you know, but even in the context of Judge Pohlmeier's litigation, you know, this type of product-to-product testing, it's not usually relevant in the context of a normal Hatch-Waxman infringement action. I mean, in that case, New Farm had tested its product, It found, using what Judge Posner had previously said was the only certain way to prove molecular structure, had that proof. It said that it was a non-infringing polymer. So there was, I mean, even in that case, there really was no motivation for Nufarm to have gone and done a comparative test with the Torfarm material, because it had done the test that previously the district court's decision said, this is the non-infringing product. What is non-infringing is a monomer or a polymer. We've done the single crystal test for the Nufarm case, shown that it was a non-infringing polymer. So it's not as though Nufarm was proceeding in bad faith in the context of its litigation. It had what was supposed to be the dispositive test. And that's why Apotex was particularly prejudiced when at the hearing in front of Judge Posner, the district court said that the type of product-to-product testing that he wanted was not the single crystal test that he previously said was going to be dispositive on the issue, but was on these molecular weight tests that this court already said on summary judgment was not going to be sufficient proof of the molecular structure that Abbott's patent claims required. So that's why we were particularly, Apotex was particularly hampered in trying to respond to Judge Posner's concerns, because there would have been no reason to do that type of product-to-product comparison testing when we had the gold standard test, which was the single crystal X-ray test result.
What about your Bayer argument?
Right. Under Bayer...
But it seems to me that what you're saying is that there could be an infringement action brought or a contempt action, and that the generic manufacturer could still amend its ANDA to describe the product in a non-infringing way, here to describe it as a polymer, and that at any point takes away the district court's jurisdiction. Would that be true if the amendment here had been filed after Judge Posner had rendered his decision?
Right. I think that an ANDA applicant is entitled to amend their ANDA application before FDA approval. They can actually even amend it after final FDA approval. And the reason why you always are amending your applications is because there's a constant back and forth between the ANDA applicant and FDA. FDA may say, we want you to add some tests. They may say, we want you to tighten up a specification. We don't like this process that you're using. We want you to do something different. You know, do you need to go run another bio study? So there's always some flux between what the application looks like at the beginning versus what it looks like at the end. And the final product that we're actually going to be able to market in the United States, that FDA is going to finally approve, is going to be that product as it is defined by the ANDA specification.
But it's a little troubling, isn't it, that you could file a new ANDA after the district court's decision or while the matter is on appeal and thereby escape contempt proceedings or even infringement proceedings? I mean, as though it's you can sit and wait to file the ANDA amendment till the last minute until you've got an unfavorable decision before the district court or even before us, and then you amend it. I mean, that can't be true, is it?
Well, I think that you're never an ANDA applicant, and again, this depends on the nature of the change that you're making. I can tell you that if I were to make a wholesale process change in my ANDA in front of FDA, FDA may not even accept that change and say, sorry, you've got to go do new bio studies, file a new ANDA. If I do that, I'm going to have to go through the same process, you know, telling the brand company, here's a new ANDA, here's my paragraph 4 certification, here's the reasons why I don't infringe, and they have the right to sue me. So it's not as though we're going to ever be able to sneak on the market by making some changes to the ANDA.
You don't share any of my concerns.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I completely understand the concern that, you know, somebody might change the ANDA and, you know, that might moot out issues, but I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing that if, you know, a district court judge were to say, I think that you're going to be infringing if you do this, but you're not going to be infringing if you do this. If you change your ANDA specification to make sure it's a non-infringing product, I mean, that's...
But here the district court proceeding was directed to the samples that were provided to the FDA, right?
The samples that were used were the BioBatch samples. That's, you know, I mean, so those were those were prepared as part of the ANDA filings. And again, you know, those biobatch samples themselves, the preparation of them, is subject to the safe harbor provisions.
Right, but the district court here was addressing the same product that you say the FDA should address under the amended ANDA.
Well, no matter what, we're not, by law, we're not going to be able to market our product unless we can prove to FDA's satisfaction that it is going to be compliant with our ANDA specification.
Well, right. I mean, there can be a proceeding if there's a false statement, but the problem is you've got two parallel remedies here provided in the statute, one before the FDA and one for infringement or possibly contempt in the district court. And the question is how to reconcile those two remedies so that you don't have conflicting results. And it would seem as though you'd have to concede that once the district court had rendered a decision, that it would no longer be possible to escape the district court's jurisdiction by amending the ANDA. I understand that that's not what happened here. The amendment took place before the district court rendered its decision. But the claim that you can amend the ANDA any time, it seems to me, is difficult to make.
But if you amend your ANDA so that you are affirmatively representing you're not going to be making an infringing product, I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, if anything, that's complying with what the district court is saying you shouldn't be doing, which is infringing this patent.
The amendment was done by someone who did not have the requisite knowledge to sign the certification. Nu-Pharm is a one-person company.
No, that's not accurate.
There's five employees.
It has five employees.
Yes.
And it's true that Nu-Pharm primarily focuses on marketing drugs, but that's, you know, I mean, there's nothing in the statute that says the only company that has the authority to sponsor an ANDA is the company that's actually going to be manufacturing the drugs.
The statute says that the certification should be done by someone with knowledge who can state that the patent is invalid or the sale of the new drug for which the application is submitted is okay. And
right.
That's Mr. Benyuk didn't have that requisite knowledge.
Well,
he's a salesman, and a very good one.
I understand, but you know that doesn't. I mean, that doesn't mean that he's made a false statement to FDA. If Nu-Pharm has the test that tells it this product is not infringing, that should be more than enough for Nu-Pharm to be able to represent in good faith that it doesn't have an infringing product.
There's a lot of money at stake. And if Mr. Benyuk files a false certification, the penalties fall on him, not Mr. Sherman. Mr. Sherman's not exposed. Apotec is not exposed. The rationale of the Bayer case doesn't seem to apply in this circumstance.
Well, I disagree that. Actually, I apologize. I'm in my time. But if I can just answer your question, is that if Dr. Sherman or Apotex puts an infringing product on the market, they're going to be responsible, you know, for damages to Apotex. If they go out and do a design around and come up with a non-infringing product, they should be entitled to go file an ANDA on that.
All right, we'll restore your rebuttal time and we'll enlarge the time, if needed, for Mr. Reedy by 13 minutes, which was the additional time we gave appellant's counsel.
Good morning. I apologize for my voice, and I think I'll be able to be heard, though. There is one quote, a very short quote, from Mr. Sherman's deposition that I think is instructive on a number of the points raised by the court in their questions. And what Mr. Sherman said was, I believe they, and he was referring both to the flake product and the spray product that Nu-Pharm had brought in their ANDA. I believe that they are non-infringing or likely to be non-infringing not because I have test results, but because I believe that it is impossible for anything to be what is claimed in the patent. And the reason that's informative...
Mr. Reed, the question that before us is not the good faith or bad faith of these people. The question is whether the district court properly had jurisdiction. And, you know, in the KSM and in additive controls, we've said that a contempt proceeding shouldn't be used where there's conflicting expert testimony, there are difficult issues. why aren't we in a situation here where Judge Posner should not have held contempt proceedings but should have left this to the infringement
case? And I think that's a very fair question. Judge Dyke, but let me address it this way. I think there's a number of steps that you see in order to see why Judge Posner proceeded correctly to treat this summarily. And it does relate to what I just said. This isn't just to say, or that is, I'm not just saying, look, he was trying to pull a fast one, which he clearly was, and which the district court clearly held he was, with respect to the subterfuge and New Farm, etc. But I understand that doesn't address your question of jurisdiction. But what I think does address the question of jurisdiction to proceed summarily here is what Judge Posner was looking at in total. And indeed, he invokes this in his opinion. He said, look, I have to look at everything there is before I decide whether I can proceed summarily. And one of the things he looked at was the bad faith of the subterfuge of using New Farm and the fact that the way that Mr. Sherman proceeded. And one of the things...
But there clearly was conflicting evidence on whether this product was infringing. And to some extent, Judge Posner seemed to have looked at the wrong thing. He seemed to have looked to the identity, to the original product or to the Abbott product rather than to the claims of the patent. So there was conflicting evidence as to whether looking at the claims to the patent, there was infringement. And in fact, because of the summary nature of the proceeding, evidence was excluded, which would have been properly submitted in the infringement proceeding itself. So, you know, why should something like this be disposed of summarily when there is this conflicting evidence and potentially difficult issues?
I think one of the reasons, first of all, I think Judge Posner correctly compared the products he should have compared, which is he compared Apotex's Torfarm product and Apotex's New Farm.
But that's not on the infringement issue. He's not supposed to be comparing the two products. He's supposed to be comparing the new product to the claims of the patent, right?
No, I think with respect to determining whether or not he can proceed summarily under the cases in this court, he is in fact supposed to make a determination whether or not there is a colorable difference between the previously enjoined product and the new product. So that's where he starts. And he finds and holds that they are identical.
Yeah, but the point is that, and you're correct, there are two steps, but isn't the question as to whether the second step, that is, where to determine whether the product is infringing, which requires addressing the claims of the patent and the new product, don't our cases suggest that we shouldn't get to that second stage in the course of a contempt proceeding where it's a close case, they're conflicting evidence? That's really my concern.
And I understand that concern. Yeah. I actually think what your cases say, the KSM case in particular says, is that if the two products are identical, you need not go to a separate infringement analysis.
Even if there's conflicting evidence?
Well, first of all, I don't think there was conflicting evidence.
But assume hypothetically that there was.
Even where there is conflicting evidence, assuming that the court can, without a week or multi, a very cumbersome proceeding, but can in a relatively short order, which includes having experts testify, can make a determination that the products are identical, then that should end the analysis. I think Judge Posner went further than he need go with respect to this analysis, because under the KSM case and the Conoco case as well, if he makes the determination that the products are the same, that ends the analysis. What the notion is that if they throw up other testing, once he's decided particularly that they came in bad faith, particularly that they had no good reason to believe when they filed their paragraph 4 certification that they were separate, that once he decides those things and then he looks at the product based on their expert's submission in front of Judge Pallmeyer and two additional experts that they submitted prior to the hearing in front of Judge Posner, he looks at all of that and concludes, based on contrasting it to the expert he found to be more credible, our expert, that the products are in fact identical, then when he goes into the further analysis of whether or not they in fact meet the claims of the patent, he is going further than they were entitled to. He did more for them
really?
Than they needed to do.
You don't have to go to the second stage if you...
The two stages that this court outlines for what should happen when a case is brought, the same person comes back with a supposed redesign, is that the court first looks to see if there's a difference. And what KSM says, if there is no difference, that ends it. And as a matter of logic, Judge Dyke, I believe that has to be the case.
I don't think it's true as a matter of logic, because you can have any testing has margins of error. I don't think that testing the thing against the original product is sufficient to satisfy the second step, that is, as to whether there's infringement. And that's the concern here. It looks as though Judge Posner has relied heavily on the identity of the products rather than doing what he should have done at the second step, which is to compare the evidence to the claims of the patent.
Well, first of all, I think it's quite clear he did the second step. But let me back up to my position, which is not what Judge Posner says. Judge Posner does not say, he follows your analysis, Judge, if I may. He says, even though I found these two products are identical, I now have to compare the second product to the patent claims. And he goes through that comparison and finds it to be infringing. But addressing your question to me and my position, which is that once you find them to be identical, otherwise, Judge, there's nothing in a Hatch-Waxman case. If you always have to look at whatever they bring, here's what Apotex could have done. Apotex could have, as Mr. Sherman sat there in court, realizing he was losing his case in front of Judge Posner, and deciding that he was still right, that there is no, despite the holdings of this court, that there is an oligomer that is called divalproic sodium, that he's still right, there is no such thing, as he testified was his motivation in bringing another ANDA. All he had to do was go under Apotex's name and refile the same product under a new ANDA, and then just have different testing supplied upon it, which goes into your margins of error, or, as we all know, you get some differences in everything, and bring new experts in front of a new judge and get a completely new bite at the apple. And under the analysis that suggests if they have anything, once they have anything to suggest it's different, then you have to go through a full analysis and you can't proceed by contempt. You would not be able to proceed by contempt against Apotex if they had baldly gone in, skipped their subterfuge, and gone in and filed the same stuff in a new ANDA. Which, by the way, and this is very telling, I think, as to what was going on here, and I think contributes greatly to what was going on with respect to the reason why summary proceedings were correct is...
But it sounds to me as though you're really eliminating the second steps, the second step that our cases require. You're saying as long as there's no colorable difference, which is the first step test, you don't need to go to the second step.
I think, Judge, I am saying that that is the logic of your cases, and I believe, Judge, under KSM, that's what the case says. It says if it's the fact that the difference, if there is no difference, Judge Posner holds they're identical, if there's no difference, let's say, between the two products, then you don't have to go to a separate analysis because you've already done it. Otherwise, if you follow the logic that I think the court is suggesting here, or that Judge Dyke is suggesting, then I think what you have to do is anybody who can come up with a new test can have a complete new ANDA, even if they're saying they've got the same product. Here it was the same product, it was just cooked a different way. But otherwise, if you can't do identity and end the analysis, and then I think I should address, in fairness to your questions, Judge Dyke, the fact that Judge Posner did do the analysis. He did go through and look at whether or not they were the same. And keep in mind that when the case got to Judge Posner, as of, let me get the date right on this, as of, I think, July 13th of 2006, Judge Pallmeyer, in her case, had already informed Apotex, or New Farm, the Apotex stalking horse, that sameness was going to be the first issue she was going to address. So the notion of whether or not the New Farm product was the same as the Apotex Tor Farm product was the same was at issue before Judge Pallmeyer, before the expert reports were filed. So there was no doubt that that was an issue. So when it comes before Judge Posner, it's not as if they're suddenly dragged away where the first time anybody has ever said to them was, hey, there's an idea of sameness here that you're going to have to prove you have a different
product. Mr. Reddy, if you were concerned that Apotex was trying to game the system, so to speak, by attempting to get another crack at a district court judge, which is the words of Judge Posner, why not simply make a motion based on collateral estoppel before Judge Pallmeyer?
And we were in the process of doing that, but once it became clear,
I'm sorry, when did you find out that Apotex was that New Farm was the stalking horse for Apotex? What was the date?
Well, it was the middle of July, July 19th of 2006.
Why didn't you move before Judge Pallmeyer for based on a collateral estoppel?
Here's what we did. and there's a couple of dates that are relevant, I think, to Judge Otero's questions. One is, on July 19th, we found out that, in fact, Beniak was fully a creature of Apotex and that Apotex still owned it. Under the cases, there's two prongs for whether or not you can bring it back to the original enjoining judge. The first one is that you have identity of parties. Our injunction says that Apotex, the Apotex product, is enjoined. If somebody else came up with a product that happened to be the same, they would be entitled to a full hearing. So it has to be Apotex. So on July 19th, we figure out it's Apotex. Then the expert reports come in, because the second prong is it the same? So we wait to see what the proceeding would be before, or what their position would be on sameness. They file only Dr. Hursthaus's affidavits and expert, or rather his expert report, which says nothing about whether or not it's the same.
If for any reason the matter is sent back down, your remedy is to bring a motion before Judge Pallmeyer based on collateral estoppel.
That would be correct. And I guess the ultimate answer to your question, Judge Otero, is once you know, as we did, and the sequence is July 19th, find out for sure the stalking horse issue. July 31st, get the expert report wherein they make no claim that it's different, other than to say that it's the mantra of Mr. Sherman, which is that it's not a ligamer. Okay. And then 15 days later, we file in front of Judge Posner.
Can I segue into the statute itself? As I read your brief, or if I try to understand your brief, it seems to assume that an order to stop FDA approval under 271A is an injunction. And I'm looking at the statute, and 271 subsection A, at least from my understanding, appears to be written in a form that does not suggest injunctive relief. To illustrate, 271B uses the word injunction. Subsection A does not. And it would seem that the mandatory language in subsection A, which is the court shall order, is inconsistent with injunctive relief, because that type of language would constrict the court in its flexibility to fashion an equitable order. How do you read the statute?
If I understand your question, I apologize if I don't get it quite right. The way we read the statute is that in the Hatch-Waxman section of the statute, the court is clearly given the power to order the FDA not to approve, which is in the nature of an injunction to order the FDA.
Well, that the B uses the word injunction, A uses the word the court shall order. My point is, when a statute uses the word shall order, that restricts the type of injunctive relief that is associated with equitable remedies. Yeah, if you understand my point.
I don't know that I do, Your Honor.
Restate it. Subsection A uses the word the court shall order.
Correct.
Subsection B uses the word injunctive relief. I would assume that the drafters intended different results by using different words.
I guess that may well be, but I don't, as far as I'm concerned, if the first section, the section A, says that the court can make an order to the FDA that the product that's been proven to be infringing not be approved, then it seems to me that if the defendant comes back with the same product, whether it be through a stalking horse or otherwise, that the court order should expand to that as well. And that's actually what we sought. We did not seek a contempt finding as such, and it is under the contempt finding that the question of the separate analysis of the infringement has to be done.
What is the act of, what is the violation of the injunction here? The order is directed to the FDA, as the parties have construed this. There's no commercial manufacture of the product. What's the violation? What act is the violation?
In our view, the violation is of the order or of the jurisdiction of the court to simply run the same product in again.
No, but what's the language? You've got to have language in the injunction. What's the language in the injunction? Which language of the injunction is being violated here?
Just so I'm clear with the court, our position is that the earlier injunctive order covered their second attempt to get the same product approved. And so what we sought from the court was not contempt.
But she said that your theory was that the original injunction was being violated. I'm just trying to understand which portion of the original order was being violated. What was the violation? Was it the filing of the second ANDA?
Yes, the filing of the second ANDA seeking an approval from the FDA would be in violation of the original order of the court, which was to the FDA not to grant an approval on this.
So they were inducing a violation by the FDA, is your theory?
Yes, that they would have induced a violation of the FDA under the order, and then, presumably, if they'd gone forward, would have themselves violated the other paragraph. But at the time that they did it, and the only thing we wanted to make clear, because if there's to be any sort of applicability of an ANDA proceeding, so go through the whole proceeding, to the same party offering the same product, then you have to be able to make it clear in your injunction that the original order covers all aspects of the same product by the same party. And so we simply asked to have the other ANDA number included. And keep in mind, Judge Dyke, that, and pursuant to some of the questioning that I think Chief Judge Michel and others were asking my opposing counsel, is that this is crystal clear what's going on here from the very time when we fashioned a draft order for Judge Posner to begin. Because we fashioned an order that said, Judge Posner, would you please order the FDA not to approve this numbered ANDA from the first case, and any other product that these guys bring that you've already held to be infringing? That's what we asked. And they fought us on it. They came to court and they said, no, you should only enter an order saying the ANDA. And the reason they did that is in the hope that some court would someday hold that even though you bring the same product, perhaps they would have brought it again in Apotex's name and just taken another bite at another run of experts. Because that's really what this case is. This case is an attempt to get another court and another bunch of experts to look at the same problem.
What about the Bayer argument?
Pardon?
What about their Bayer argument?
I think their Bayer argument can be dealt with as follows, and I really mean this. It's too little and too late, in the sense that to do the Bayer proposal for a modification of label, okay, which hasn't been accepted, after Judge Posner has gone through the summary proceeding that he went through, and while we are waiting adjudication of that proceeding with respect to the briefing, etc., is too little too late.
Surely if they file the amendment before any court proceedings for infringement or contempt are commenced, under our decision in Bayer, the court should simply say the ANDA claims a non-infringing product. There's no theory to proceed here, right?
I don't actually think that the court would be so restrictive. I think the court would have to reconcile its principle in Bayer with respect to the principle of a simple court case, which is, for example, let's say what they
have done. But you're saying that even before the filing of the infringement action, they can't...
About the second infringement action.
The second infringement action, that they can't come under Bayer by amending the ANDA to describe a non-infringing product.
Correct, and here's why not. If they could, here's what they could have done. After they lost in front of Judge Posner, having lost most of the issues on summary judgment and then been affirmed in this court, after they lost in front of Judge Posner in the second hearing, if they all they had to do, if Bayer controls everything and there is no effect of the adjudication that their product is infringing by Judge Posner fully on the merits, then all they would have had to do was get a new ANDA number, have Apotex file a new ANDA, and try and change the label to be polymeric rather than oligomeric. I don't believe, and this would be an issue for this court to decide as a matter of first impression, I think, on those issues. I don't believe if we were, again, as we did here, able to show that the product they were offering this time was identical to the last product that had already been found to be an oligomer and found to be infringing. I don't believe that the court should decide that they are entitled to completely occupy the Hatch-Waxman system again, get another judge to take a look at another set of experts and everything, simply by firing over the transom Barry Sherman's theory that there are no oligomers in diethyl peroxide.
Wait a moment. I don't understand. I mean, there wouldn't be a second infringement action under their theory, under Bayer, if they amended before the infringement action began. They amend the ANDA.
I misspoke.
Yeah.
What they would be doing there is not getting a second shot in terms of a lawsuit, but avoiding it altogether. Here's a man who thinks that there are no oligomers of divalproic sodium. That's why he did the second thing. This makes it clear in the quote I read you. He decides that there are no oligomers of it, therefore any divalproic sodium he comes up with will be non-oligomeric and he can avoid infringement. He's already lost that issue in this court and before Judge Posner. So under the theory that Bayer controls everything and that there is no effect to a finding, he could simply change the label and file the same thing in a second ANDA.
So your theory is that Bayer is limited to a situation in which there has been no infringement litigation commenced with respect to the old product.
Bayer is limited to a situation where you cannot simply avoid the effect of the Hatch-Waxman judgment you've already lost. There's a finding by a court that your product is in fact an oligomer, a finding by this court affirming that, a finding by this court that there are oligomers of divalproic sodium. You can't avoid all that by saying, I'm taking the same product, already found to be all those things, and I'm just declaring to the FDA that it's a problem. I don't think you should be able to avoid it. That would be up to this court, but I don't think you should be able to do that.
Mr. Redding?
Yes.
I'm still struggling with the statute, and I'm trying to figure it out. In your brief, you seem to assume that an order under 271A is an injunction. Am I correct in understanding your brief? Is it an injunction?
I think we equate the concept of ordering the FDA not to do something with enjoining the FDA from doing something, yes.
If it's in the nature of an injunction, does eBay have any implications here? In other words, if it's in the nature of an injunction, and if eBay holds or held that judges need not grant injunctions after finding infringements, couldn't we have certain situations where the court would not order the FDA as called for under 271 if we imbue 270A1 with equitable notions?
I missed the part of the question with respect to
Equitable notions. Under eBay, eBay says that judges shouldn't always issue injunctions. If we interpret 271 as an injunction or injunctive relief, there'll be certain situations where judges may not issue orders under 271, which seems to be inconsistent with the statute, which says the court shall order.
Yes, I guess I think, Judge, that you can have mandatory injunctions that are statutorily mandated, but they don't necessarily become non-injunctions simply because they're mandated. In other words, if the question is, since the statute mandates an order here, it cannot therefore be an injunction because judges don't always have to issue an injunction when they find a violation and have the power to issue an injunction, I would say no. I would say that it's still, that order is still injunctive in nature. It's still an equitable remedy. It's still injunctive in nature, even if it's mandatory. And I think that, and I'm afraid I can't come up with any, but I think there are probably other places in the law where there are mandatory injunctions, but they are in fact injunctions still, even though they're injunctions.
What difference does it make what label you give it? Whether you call it a statutory order or a statutorily compelled injunction, what difference does it make?
Chief Judge Michel, to me, nothing. I believe whether we talk about it being an order or an injunction, it has the same applicable, it rings in the same world. It's in the same notion of equitable relief, and it is in fact, what we were doing here is we simply asked Judge Posner to determine, as we had determined, that this was the same product that they'd already had their bite at the apple on. And once we established that, we asked him to simply expand the order to make it clear to the FDA that their new ANDA number was covered, because we knew their position was if you have a new ANDA number, you know, you're not covered. So that's all we were trying to do. We only wanted a clarification or a modification of the order to make it clear that it covered this particular ANDA, because the original order covered any product of the defendant that had previously held to be infringing. So once we established that New Farm was Tor Farm's stalking horse in the depositions in the middle of July, and then once we had it absolutely clear from our scientist, and no contest from the scientists in their expert reports filed with Judge Ballmeyer, that there was any issue of sameness that we saw at that time, we then felt that we had both the issues, that we had the defendant.
Yeah, yeah. Your judgment isn't in question here. Only Judge Posner's judgment is in question.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
No one's quarreling with your, at least for the purpose of our discussion, no one's quarreling with your litigation choices. The question is whether Posner acted lawfully or not.
I understand that, and I should put it in those terms. With respect to what Judge Posner did, he did do what we asked him to do, which was he expanded the order to include the new antimony. So he did not actually, while he went through the contempt analysis and went through the separate and independent infringement analysis that the contempt analysis requires, he went through it, he went back and found it to be an illiterate, found and accepted our expert, Dr. Atwood's testimony in that regard, and disregarded what he regarded as the science of Dr. Hirsthorst and Dr. Stevens as not probative at all.
I don't understand how you can file papers to initiate a proceeding that you call contempt if what you're really doing functionally is asking a judge to clarify a prior injunction by making it more specific, i.e. add the ANDA number of the second ANDA. That seems like you're asking to reopen or amend the original proceeding, not bringing a new contempt proceeding.
Well, understand, Chief Judge Michel, that if you look at our papers, you won't see that we filed a contempt proceeding. We filed a proceeding that asked for, we said that they were in contempt in the course of our proceeding, but our requested remedy and what we filed was, we said, Judge, your previous order covers this new ANDA of theirs, and we would like you to modify your order to make that clear to the FDA. That's what we said.
Yeah, but he, if I recall correctly, he in effect, without saying, I find Apotex in contempt, he did find them in contempt, and he actually threatened them with unspecified sanctions if they persisted.
And I think
so he seemed to treat your papers, however they were labeled or however they were intended, as asking him to make a contempt finding. He then made it, and then he threatened that if the contemnatious conduct didn't immediately stop, that there would be sanctions against them, not against FDA, but against them. So I'm very confused about what is it we have in front of us. It looks to me like we have a contempt judgment with threatened but not ordered sanctions.
I think that your analysis, that Judge Posner went on to do a contempt analysis and holding after we asked him to modify the order, and we did in fact say to him that in fact their conduct is contumacious. He did that. I think that's fair. I think where the contempt comes in.
What's the point here, though? I mean, what's the point? Are you saying that some standard other than the standard for contempt proceedings should be applied here?
I actually think that if you only want to get the if you prove identity of product, then I think you can live with either the contempt standard. Or
so you are suggesting that we don't have to apply the contempt standard here.
No, I have no problem at all with the court applying the contempt standard. I'm happy to have the court
So suppose we find that the contempt portion of the ruling was erroneous, and we vacate it. I take you to be saying, well, I don't really care because I win anyway, because FDA is ordered not to allow this product to ever be marketed by Apotex, and that's all I want anyway.
Well, that's correct. Assuming, of course, that in whatever you do to make a finding with respect to the contempt proceeding, that you continue to accept that Judge Posner was correct, that this was, in fact, them filing the same product in front of the FDA, which is what he held. And if that's true, then it is clear that it should be covered by his original order.
Well, I don't understand why we have to allow any part of his ruling to stand, because all he did, if we put aside the contempt judgment, is to say that my original injunction, which referred generically, I'm not intending to be clever here, generally referred to future applications, all he did was to say, such as, and then he gave the number of the second ANDA application. So if all he did is clarify or make more detailed, more specific, his original injunction, he's allowed to do that, one would think, under the power of the earlier proceeding, doesn't need any separate authority to do so.
That would be my view, Judge. But I think he went the extra distance. In other words, he had this case had already been adjudicated. This company had already taken the same product, in his view, and I think correctly held, and certainly not by any abuse of discretion reversal. In his view, they had taken the same product, given it to a stalking horse, and tried to blow it through the FDA and get a new hearing in front of a new judge with new experts and new tests. That's what he thought they did.
How do you know that? I don't understand where you're getting the new proceeding, new judge from.
As soon as they take the same product and introduce it to a new ANDA, that's what they're trying for. And that was always their position. That's their position in this court.
But you filed the infringement action before Judge Pallmeyer.
Yes.
Right? And what you're saying is there are three types of proceedings. You could bring an infringement proceeding, you could bring a contempt proceeding, or you could ask to modify the original injunction. What's the authority for bringing that latter type of proceeding as opposed to litigating that in the infringement proceeding?
The authority for that is whatever inherent authority there is to a fully adjudicated case.
But what case says that there are three options that the patentee has here? Infringement, contempt,
I don't think we have three options. My own belief is that once we are convinced that it's the same party with the same product that's previously been enjoined, we have to go back to Judge Posner. That's how I think it works.
In a contempt proceeding.
What do you mean have to? What blocks you from litigating in front of Judge Pallmeyer other than you'd prefer not to?
No, I guess...
What legal obstacle blocks you from just litigating the case that you filed, which happened to be assigned to Pallmeyer?
Keep in mind that when we filed it, we had no information with respect to how involved Apotex was, and that all came out later in the injunction.
Yeah, but that's not the question. The question is, what precluded you from simply continuing with the Pallmeyer suit?
I don't believe anything precludes us other than the principle that I recognize at the law, and I think we cited some cases with respect to that, that no party has the right to simply relitigate something.
If they'd been before Judge Pallmeyer, if you'd stayed before Judge Pallmeyer, this supplemental expert reports would have been timely, right? The ones that Judge Posner excluded.
They might have been timely. I don't remember the schedule. They might have been timely, although keep in mind that was advanced by the fact that they filed the reports and immediately filed a motion for summary judgment.
Okay, but you're not contending that if the proceeding had stayed before Judge Pallmeyer, that these supplemental expert reports would have been untimely, right?
I'm not contending that.
Right. So why is it fair that all of a sudden you can bring a contempt proceeding which is so summary in nature that they're not allowed to submit the supplemental expert reports?
I think it's fair because it depends on what you think they were doing. And in this case, what Judge Posner held unequivocally what they were doing, which is proceeding in. They never tested the products before they filed their second ANDA. And the reason they didn't test them is because Barry Sherman thought there is no illegal. So they never tested them beforehand. I believe there's an obligation in the law in the cases we cite under this court, that before they filed the second ANDA with what turned out to be an identical product, they had an obligation to test. They didn't do that. None of the testing that they did...
Where does it come from? Well, what case holds that he who wishes to file a new ANDA on the theory that the new drug doesn't infringe, even though the old one did, has to have new test results?
I think, Judge, that the concept is...
I understand the concept. My question goes to what case holds that.
I believe that in the Stryker case, that principle is set forward. What Stryker says is that it's up to the infringer to take all reasonable steps within its power to comply with the court's order. That means finding out. In this case, what he actually says in his deposition, what Sherman says is, I came up with a new method which is more likely to be infringing.
But they did have tests. They tested the thing.
They
right?
had not a single test when they filed their ANDA and when they, their paragraph 4.
No, but later on they had tests, right?
Later on they went and got the Hearst House expert test, which they submitted in front of Judge Pallmeyer. But the obligation that I'm talking about is if you have already litigated it all the way to the end, you've already litigated a product, you don't believe what the appellate court and the district court have said, and so you want to do it again with new experts, hoping that you'll get somebody to say there is no oligomer or dial
but here there's also a different way, as you put it, of cooking it.
Correct, which Judge Posner...
Well, as I recall the second ANDA, it said it's cooked a different way and it's a different product.
No, the second ANDA doesn't say anything about it being different than the first product. In fact, it ignores the first product altogether. And neither did their expert report when they first turned it in front of Judge Pallmeyer say anything, despite the fact that that issue was joined in front of Judge Pallmeyer. The cooked it a different way, Barry Sherman says, I cooked it a different way that made it more likely that it would be infringing. If you remember the original opinion...
What I'm trying to figure out is who is owed the obligation? You're emphatically saying an obligation to do testing before filing ANDA 2 exists. And I'm trying to figure out, well, who is owed that duty? FDA? Otherwise, we're wasting FDA's time by having a second ANDA when there are no new tests?
I think both the party that won the case, okay, when you bring the same product again in a new ANDA, but more importantly, really, is the court system. If you believe that the product you file is more likely to be an oligomer and therefore infringing than the first one you brought, and you have the obligation before you supposedly design around by simply changing the method of manufacture, which has no predictability that it's going to actually change.
So your theory is they could be held in contempt for not doing testing before filing the ANDA.
I believe that they couldn't be held in contempt simply for not testing before doing the ANDA, but that they have to pay the penalty of when they don't test before the ANDA with respect to how it is treated. In other words, they then, and Judge Posner does this, he says, I infer that there is reasons why they didn't do any testing before they filed the ANDA. I infer that not only did they try and walk around, they tried to keep the injunction from reading what it should have read. They tried to hide the fact that it was still Apotex running the whole show by having Nufarm do it. And they filed a product
that evidence, Sherman thought... So you're saying it's evidence in support of a contempt finding?
Absolutely. And it would be evidence in support of it being the same product under a different ANDA number for the expansion of the order. Either one.
Yeah. Let me come back for one moment to the schedule that Judge Posner set up. When you brought the contempt proceeding, did he set a schedule for the filing of expert reports? What did he do?
No, I don't believe he did. I think that he set a schedule for the hearing and that he allowed people to file expert reports if they had additional experts that they wanted to file, and that the defendants filed two new experts.
What was the interval
Stevens
between...
Stevens and SEMA were both not present in the Pallmeyer case, but were present in our hearing.
What was the elapsed time between the original contempt proceeding and the submission of the contested affidavits, contested reports?
You mean in terms of the time after Judge Posner held his hearing?
Yeah.
Just a couple of weeks.
But when you said too little, too late, I take it you're suggesting that because they didn't have that testing evidence to submit at the live hearing, that they were properly barred from submitting it 2 weeks later.
I actually said too little, too late about the Bayer issue with respect to the proposed labeling change, but I do believe too little, too late also applies here.
What's the schedule? I'm trying to figure this out. When was the contempt proceeding filed? What did Judge Posner say about submitting expert reports? How long did they have to do that?
We filed our motion on August 15th. I don't believe that Judge Posner gave any schedule with respect to the filing of additional experts.
So there was no schedule at all for the filing of expert reports?
Correct. There was no schedule at all for the filing of expert reports.
Well, then what was the basis for barring them from filing the supplemental expert reports?
Yeah, how could they be late if there was no deadline? Right?
No. The position that Judge Posner takes, which I think is quite reasonable, is you've already had what I call the sameness issue, the issue of whether or not it's the same product again, at issue in the Judge Pallmeyer case. Now Abbott has enough information to believe you're the same, so we bring it over in front of Judge Posner. And he says, well, I'll set a hearing to determine whether or not this is the same product. And so he sets a summary hearing for that to be held. He says, look, if you want to bring experts to talk about it, bring experts to talk about it.
And when was the hearing?
The hearing was a couple of weeks later. We filed on August 15th.
So mid-August you filed, late August the hearing is held, and then 2 weeks after that they submit reports and he refuses to accept them.
Yes, it was actually a week after that. It was September 6th. But keep in mind, Judge, that...
What's the harm of allowing the reports in and then rendering judgment after the reports are in.
Well,
we lost a week. I mean, what's such a big problem about waiting one more week before finalizing the contempt rule?
Here's the harm, I think. At least the harm is, and I have to infer what Judge Posner perceived. The harm is that he had already given, that these people were, in his view, already trying to do an end around. They were already trying to get a new set of scientific
bites. I don't understand the connection. Accepting all of his findings for the purpose of my question, that they acted in bad faith and stalking horse and no reason to think it was different and all the rest, assume all that is correctly found by him. Still, why doesn't he allow the reports submitted a week after the hearing to come in and then, based on the fuller record, decide the sameness issue?
I think he felt that what was going on is that if he did that, he gave them the reward of their two bites at the apple. He basically has a full additional scientific...
Yeah, but he's got to have a fair proceeding in which people have the opportunity to develop expert testimony. And your original theory was they should have done it before Judge Pallmeyer, but it now turns out that they weren't untimely with these expert reports if they'd been back before Judge Pallmeyer. We can assume that. And why is it that Judge Posner doesn't give them time to do the expert reports? You can't get an expert report ready in a week or two, right?
Well, I think they did, but what happened was on August 15th, we filed our motion, remembering that basically it's based on the sameness of the two products, their first product and their second product, already at issue before Judge Pallmeyer. They already had experts in Judge Pallmeyer's case. When we get to our hearing 2 weeks later, they show up with three experts, all of whom testify about the sameness issue. Judge Posner said that's enough. If this is to be a summary proceeding, if they are not entitled to a full hearing on to get another bite of the apple simply by producing, I've got the same product, but now I'm bringing in additional expert reports. I want another bite of the oligomer.
Well, they wanted to put in expert reports in rebuttal to your expert reports. That's what these reports were, weren't they?
Well, they had an opportunity.
I mean, is that not correct? Weren't they rebuttal expert reports?
I think that they are rebuttal expert reports only in the sense that we were also proceeding on the same schedule. We filed simultaneously before Judge Pallmeyer on July 31st. We made our motion on August 15th. 2 weeks later, we were to appear at the hearing. So whoever wanted to file a rebuttal, if we wanted to file a rebuttal to what their expert had said in front of Judge Pallmeyer, they could have done that, because we brought our experts.
But there was no schedule set for the rebuttal expert report.
I think, Judge, what we have here is a judge handling a summary proceeding where he says, basically, okay, the parties say this is the same thing. It looks like you're trying to do an end around to get a chance to get all this scientific stuff looked at a second and third time. I'm going to hold a hearing in 2 weeks to find out whether that's true. Show up and bring your experts. I think that's quite fair. I don't think that he had to go through, turn it into the same proceeding Judge Pallmeyer was doing, with everybody taking all the additional time, accepting new experts on every issue under the sun, is the same thing as letting it go in front of Judge Pallmeyer. And if there's to be any meaning in a court having already decided this issue, then he's entitled to say, all right, let's show up in 2 weeks and have a hearing. And they brought two additional experts to that hearing that they hadn't brought in front of Judge Pallmeyer.
You're saying he set a date of August 30th and then let all the parties bring whatever evidence.